Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 12th, 2018, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. My voice is still a little lower than usual. That is some post-SciComm camp goodness. If you're interested in SciComm camp, you want to know what all of the fun is about, check out SciCommCamp.com. This week, it's a great episode, but before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because of the support of listeners just like you. If you want to pledge your support, the best way to do so is to visit www.patreon.com, that's patreon.com/talknerdy. This week, I want to thank Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. If you want to hear your name called out on the show, all you've got to do is what I just told you to do. Wow, I'm tired as I'm recording this. Patreon.com/talknerdy. But I did want to tell you that I have some new stuff up in the Talk Nerdy store, and I think it's super cute, and I want you to check it out. Talk Nerdy store is talknerdymerch.com, like merchandise. TalkNerdyMerch.com. New designs, super cool stuff for the holidays. I know it's getting cold outside, so we've got hoodies and beanies and fun things like that. Check it out. It's cool. It's a great way to support the show, and it's also kind of a cool way to show your support of the show, right? Because you're wearing it in public, hopefully. All right, guys. This week's episode is... it's deep and it's beautiful. And I have to admit, it was a refreshing conversation that I was able to have. I remotely connected with David George Haskell. He's a professor of biology and environmental studies at the University of the South, where he served as chair of biology. He's also 2014 to 15 fellow of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, a fellow of the American Council of Learned Societies, and an elective member of the American Ornithologists Union. He's done research in animal ecology, evolution, and conservation, and he's been funded by the NSF, the EPA, Fish and Wildlife, the World Wildlife Fund, and a bunch of other great places. He has written multiple books, but his latest one is called The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. It was so informative, so emotional. I just think it was a really important chat that I had the opportunity to have with him. And now I'm really excited to share it with all of you. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. David George Haskell. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you. It's a delight to join you.
Also, it's probably not morning for you, is it? Are you on the West Coast like I am?
I am in the mountains right now in Colorado, so just a one time zone away.
Ah, so it's just now lunchtime for you. Thank you for sharing your lunch hour with me and extending just a little bit. So I'm really excited that we were finally able to connect. You have a book which is not even really new anymore. So now I think it's probably appropriate to talk about both of your books that really focus on humanity, but also nature, connectivity, and the root of all of this, haha, no pun intended, really is the tree. So I want to start with that. What made you interested in trees, and why have you dedicated so much of your incredible science writing to them?
Well, we live on a sylvan planet, of course. We owe our lives as humans, both in the present moment, every breath we take, and most of the soil that we depend on is in some way related to trees. And of course, all our music and literature, at least in the pre-digital age, was all mediated through trees and cellulose and so forth. So the human is partly made from trees in the present moment, but also in deep time. We evolved, you know, the primate lineage is a sylvan lineage. It's a lineage that has a deep connection to trees. So there are those interconnections that I think are very real from a human-centered perspective, but also from the perspective of a storyteller, someone who wants to share with others some of the amazing stories of science. Trees are the champion networkers. And so one of my goals was to share some of the ideas that are emerging from science, and I would argue also from ethics, about interconnection and networking, and trees were wonderful ways to make that very real. Trees in quite different parts of the world, but trees everywhere, massively networked, and people are part of those networks. So just a great place to do some storytelling around science and nature and people.
And of course, I think the very first thought that comes to my mind is this sort of paradox that although from an evolutionary perspective, we really did emerge from the trees. You know, Australopithecus, for example, our kind of earliest common ancestor that we know about was arboreal. Yet we, as kind of a modern species, live in cities, and many of us don't see trees on a regular basis. And, you know, I can't remember the last time that I sat in a forest and experienced the trees. That's almost kind of a vacation goal for individuals is, oh, I'm going to go out and see the trees as if they live in zoos or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's that kind of strange juxtaposition in the modern era, isn't there?
There is, although, you know, many cities are also full of trees. Take New York City. 20% of the land surface of New York City is, in fact, tree canopy cover. And this is not just in Prospect Park or in Central Park. Of course, many neighborhoods have trees in them. And the bonds between people and trees, both the conscious bond of people noticing the tree, but also the many subconscious links, say the trees cooling the street or cleaning the air or changing the way that people move on the street, are very, very real in the city. And this is one of the things that I was discovered and was astounded by. Studying trees in Manhattan and seeing how deeply interwoven with the lives of people the trees were there, just as much as, say, in the olive groves around Jerusalem, where, of course, people who are growing olive trees are deeply connected to the lives of those creatures, or in the Amazon rainforest, where people are living within the forest and have lived within the forest for thousands of years. So, indeed, in our culture, we imagine in some ways that trees are somewhat distant from us. What I discovered again and again in all the places that I traveled, that trees were in fact deeply interconnected with us. Perhaps the disconnection is in conscious awareness of thought about what a tree is and how it's related to our lives. So now this takes very different shapes in different cities. New York City has 20% canopy cover. Denver has just 4%. And that's partly because Denver was built on essentially a short grass prairie. And there were trees just along the rivers and the streams in that area. And so the way in which urban forests manifest in the West or on the coast is different from in the mountains or in the tropics or in the subtropics or the poles. So the stories take very different forms, but within the city, the tree is still a very, very important part of our lives. And the forests that are seemingly separate from us, say the Great Boreal Forest where people live, but the majority of people, say in North America, are not living within the boreal forest, yet our lives are utterly dependent on those forests because the forests are great stores of carbon. They regulate the rainfall. They mitigate in some ways some of the great profligacy of our own lives. They act as buffers, saving us from the disastrous consequences of our own actions. So even forests that are quite distant from urbanized areas are in fact deeply interwoven with our present lives, but especially with our future lives.
And I really want to take, you know, quite a bit of time, I think, today to talk about exactly how we as human beings are connected, whether it be sort of overt or whether it be something that we don't always take stock of. But I just want to reiterate what you just said, because I think it's so important that you're right. It's not that we are not connected to the trees. We absolutely are. But maybe there's something so fundamental about the trees, something so intrinsically natural about the trees that we don't even tend to notice that they're there.
Yes. Well, of course, we live in a world where our attention is more and more drawn away from living interconnections with the earth community in the present moment, which is who we are. I mean, we're animals, we're interrelated with creatures on the second by second moment. And we now are surrounded by devices and institutional structures that are explicitly designed to take our attention and draw it into other realms, into realms that will serve the short-term needs, the short-term desires of those who have designed those attention-getting devices. And so trees in that way are like many other creatures within our living communities, that including the microbial community, the birds, the insect community, and the other people who we do not see, and certainly don't see the interconnections, where this isn't just about people versus everything else. It's about our inattention and the great challenge of our times, that inattention is being made more and more severe through design, not by accident, but by design. And so trees, in some ways, symbolize what is also true in many other realms within the human community, and also among humans and our kin and neighbors, our biological kin and neighbors, the other species with which we share the planet.
Oh, absolutely. And the way that we have managed to sort of separate ourselves, at least consciously separate ourselves from not just the trees, but as you said, all of the other organisms that we share this planet with. Of course, we are not actually separate from them, but we like to think that we are, with our concrete walls and our air conditioners. And, you know, I would don't want a single fly in the house, and I, you know, want to clean the spider webs out from the corners on a regular basis. There's this move, this almost, you know, deep desire for cleanliness, quote unquote, for kind of an antiseptic quality mm-hmm. to our lives that is, we feel, incompatible with the natural world in a way.
Yes. And in that, there is a great loneliness, of course, because in pushing away those other creatures, we're pushing away the creatures, the sensory impressions, the relationships that made us human, that are part of our neurobiological, psychological, bodily heritage. So is it any wonder that we feel so alienated from one another and the world, where we live within paradigms, mental paradigms, that tell us we need to be away from those other creatures and interact with what so-called nature, that thing that our current language imagines as separate from us, in highly mediated forms, like the nature documentary, which is an anesthetic to make us think that the world is still okay, the other rest of the community of life is still there, whereas in fact, forests are being lost at the rate of tens of thousands of square kilometers a year, and yet we hang in carefully curated places pictures of trees and use trees as symbols that don't indicate the truth of what's happening in the world now. So indeed, we're lonely.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. You know, I think at this point it might not be as in the consciousness of the listeners of Talk Nerdy, but probably at this point, at least a year, maybe several years ago, I had a guest on the show named Jo Ruxton, and she was a producer for mm-hmm. these large BBC documentaries. And she did, she worked quite a bit on Blue Planet. And when she came on my show, she had recently produced a documentary called A Plastic Ocean. And she kind of mentioned something that really resonated with me, is that she felt an ethical obligation to make this film, because in working on Blue Planet, she realized that although the goal, I guess, was to produce something aspirational, it was so sanitized for the viewer. She was like, Kara, you don't understand. To get those pristine shots took days, weeks, months, because almost inevitably, when you pan a portion of the ocean, there's garbage mm-hmm. within it. And so we'd have to sanitize these shots and cut them at just the right moment in order to make the idea in the viewer's mind that that's what the ocean still looks like when it just doesn't.
Yes. Yeah, so in other words, we're peddling in lies. And why are those lies popular? It's because they help us feel okay. And we all feel, I mean, in the political, social, ecological context now, that we're in a time of great crisis, and we need that connection to beauty. So the good side of this is that writing and documentary film and sound artists who show us some of the the diversity of life, are reminding us of the great beauty of the world. Not everything has to be about the garbage in the oceans and so forth. So there's that reminder, there's that inspiration to go and actually form real relationships instead of relationships mediated through the screen with the ocean, with the river, with the birds, with trees. So there's an inspiration, but also, but if it's not, if those projects do not also acknowledge the fact that it takes days to get a shot of a coral reef that doesn't have a bit of garbage flowing through it, it's a lie, and it does a disservice. It dishonors the community of life in which we are born and in which we have our lives. So it's a very delicate balance between inspiring and sharing the beauty and the diversity and the importance of the world, and also acknowledging the deep fracture and the grief and the loss that is happening now. And I think both of those, and I hope in my own work that both of those things are true, is that, wow, trees are extraordinary beings. Tens of thousands of connections form the life of one particular tree. That's amazing. And trees are thriving in some places, partly because people are working with the trees, story of great cooperation and partnership. And yet in other places, the story is much more broken. So I think, and this is one of the great tensions in any engagement with life's communities, between that darkness and the great light that we're seeing there. So.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I recently had the opportunity to spend a bit of time in the Peruvian Amazon, and I think that I had read about it, and I think somewhere buried within my consciousness, I knew about the great struggles that the individuals living and working there were dealing with illegal gold mining, with deforestation. But flying in to the Peruvian Amazon, which generally, I mean, and it was, don't get me wrong, it was breathtaking, because never in my life have I seen such lush, green environment. There were huge swaths of brown that looked very out of place. And I remember being taken aback by the fact that this seemingly, quote unquote, pristine kind of last vestige, what we, I think, fantasize about as true kind of unadulterated nature, it in and of itself is really holding on. It really is struggling. And I was really excited to see that the ecotourism company that I went there to do some work with, Rainforest Expeditions, had a huge educational and interactive component to their work dealing with the castaña trees, the Brazil nut trees, and how important they were for the ecology of the community and how important it was just for reforestation of these, you know, of these ecosystems that we rely on. Even here in the United States, we rely on, you know, the Peruvian Amazon. We don't think of it, but of course it has an effect on our lives. But it was quite jarring, I think, for me. And I wish that more people had the opportunity to see that what we are struggling with in our own local communities is happening in places that we think of as like kind of left alone. They're simply not.
Yes. Now, well, and across tropical forest at the moment, we're losing about 50,000 square kilometers of tropical forest per year. So, you know, it's not, of course, not just Peru, Ecuador, Brazil, also Southeast Asia and across Africa. So that's part of the crisis of forest loss that's happening now. It's particularly intense in tropical forests, partly because of things that are happening there, as you mentioned, gold mining, logging, resource extraction, the oil that that goes on to the global oil markets. Some of that is coming from Peru, from Ecuador, for some particularly rich oil deposits there. But also, so global climate change is changing the rainfall and temperature dynamics in the forest. So even without loggers in the forest or people clearing the forest, the forest is greatly diminished, and through fire and drought, the forest seems to be tipping into a different state of being. I wanted to just address one phrase that you mentioned, sort of unadulterated nature in the rainforest. And that's the forests of South America have had people living within them for at least 9,000 years, probably much older. And in fact, the diversity of the forest was formed in relation to those people. So many forest soils in the Amazon have a human signature within them because people, agricultural communities, had been working in the forest to over millennia. And so there is a notion in North America in particular that, you know, we, wilderness is someplace, and in fact, this is written in law, is a place untrammeled by man. That's from the U.S. Wilderness Act. And yet, those places, all of those...
But of course, that's such a colonial view, right?
Yeah, all of those places. And from an ecological point of view, it's important to note that the diversity of the forest is partly a product of good human work within those places. Nature, so-called, does not need to be cleansed of people in order to be beautiful and good and diverse. And that's the sort of the old school version of conservation, is we need to kick all the people out and put a barrier around an ecosystem. And I think that's it's a deeply un-Darwinian view, because it views humans as outside of the community of life, which is, from a scientific point of view, just plainly not the case. Mm-hmm. And it's also, of course, contributes to deep human injustice, where the people are causing most of the problems in the world, high consumption Westerners, putting the blame for environmental destruction and preserving nature through the process of disenfranchising and deracinating the very people who are living in most productive and beautiful connection with forest ecosystems. So there are all kinds of layers of human potential and human injustice within these questions about ecology.
And from whom, you know, we stand, and I say we as somebody living in the West, so much to learn. I mean, if not from the historic injustices of, you know, just the terrible, terrible colonial genocide, basically, here on, you know, American soil during the early settlements, but across the globe, just taking the time to step back and understand that indigenous peoples in basically every continent lived harmoniously with the land for generations. And there's just so much, I think, policy that we can learn from these individuals. And you're right, it's the exact opposite to come in and say, no, we need to be hands off. That's how we're going to allow. It's almost like you can see like the teenage growing pains of coming up with those explanations, you know, like it's very short-sighted, which I think in many ways our governmental policy has sort of always been, at least here in this country.
Yes, and it's sort of the colonial era, and these injustices are not things from the past, but they're ongoing now. So of course, indigenous communities in the Amazon are struggling greatly with loss of cultural diversity, loss of life, loss of land, loss of connection from a number of different sources. But it's happening, of course, in North America as well. But we're in a time now where the midterm elections are coming up, and guess what? People in so-called reservations, people of indigenous communities, First Nations communities, are being disenfranchised from voting through various schemes around the country. And the pipeline struggles and so on have shown that any indigenous communities who stand up for their rights on their land will be criminalized and attacked. So it's the story has not changed, which means that our paradigm, our philosophy hasn't changed. And that's the big challenge. We need to reconnect with the living community, the human and beyond human living communities, in order to move to a more just future. And that's part of what connecting with trees is about. It's stepping out away from the screen, into the street, to just notice and start to form relationship with trees on the city street is an act that will produce great joy. It will uncover all kinds of cool stories, cool interconnections. But it's also a political act. It's an act of resistance to the forces that want us not to believe that there is a truth in this world, that want to disconnect us from that community so the community can continue to be plundered.
I have to point out, and I have to kind of ask you, you know, as somebody who has dedicated your life, you know, looking at your work, your writings, your teachings, as a biologist, as a conservationist, as an ecologist, you don't sound to me like many modern scientists, even those who really take on science communication as an important part of the work. And what I mean by that is that you have a very holistic view that is not just scientific, but political, sociological, psychological. And I worry that many modern science communicators have a fear of the political, and they kind of put a line in the sand that says, I'm going to stick to my science. I don't want to venture into politics because there's too much partisanship. It's too contentious. I may not be taken seriously. You know, whatever their reason is, I worry that we remain so siloed in these areas that the true picture never comes together until you are multidisciplinary. You know, the way that you really have been your entire career. Can you tell me, you know, why you chose that route and whether you see the same kinds of problems that I see?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think my writing doesn't aim to be about science communication or about ecology or environmental ethics, so on. I locate myself in particular places. For example, one tree on a city street in New York, or one patch of forest in an old-growth forest in Tennessee. And my method is just to return and again to that place and try to listen for what's happening there, and then to understand what I've observed through hopefully opening my senses to the place. Try to understand that through talking to other scientists, to anthropologists, to people who live in the community. So my work, I've tried to ground it really in the experience of living in the world, and then to try to understand that world through my own particular lens. Somebody else with the same experiences would have a different lens, a different set of expectations and thoughts about it. But to wrap these various strands of knowing into essays that wrap together a bit of natural history and science, and then of course science often leads us to ethical questions, and think about how those ethical questions might be answered, or at least we might move towards an answer through engagement in the life of community, whether that community is on a city street or in a forest. So that's what I've tried to do here. And I think other people are doing other forms of writing and other forms of communication. Of course, your work is one of those forms. And I think the wonderful thing about Homo sapiens is that we're so diverse in our proclivities, in the things that we find interesting, in the ways that we want to communicate with one another, and the work we want to do. So I do think there's room for a great deal of different forms of creative expression, of thinking about science, thinking about ethics, and so on. So I don't see what I'm doing as in any way superior beyond or to what other people are doing. I see myself as a student of people, of other writers, whether they be poets or journalists or writers of musical scores expressing themselves through other means. I do the word science communication is one that I struggle with a little bit, because I think what people in that field are doing is so much more than communicating science. And an analogy here maybe is a musician. When a musician mm-hmm. sits down, they don't refer to themselves as a note communicator. No. They'll get inside the music and put their own interpretation on it. And there's a great deal of skill, you know, years and years of work to understand which phrases need to be emphasized and which diminished. And then, of course, improvisers are bringing their own melodies into this. And when I read science journalism, science communication, that's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm feeling. So I don't know quite what the right word needs to be, science jazz, or to get beyond this notion that, you know, there's a body of science that then needs transmitting outward. The word doesn't seem up to the great vitality of the work that's being done now. I really do think that the kind of writing in particular that we do is the appropriate tone, the appropriate degree of politicization depends on context. So if the goal is to report the results of a particular environmental study that has great political weight, indeed, we do need to report those results in a way that isn't highly partisan or that omits important parts of the story because they don't match with our political views. At the same time, though, if there are, say, for example, we discover that 40% of amphibians are endangered or very close to endangered. That seems to, that's a scientific discovery. It's data, it's a set of observations, it's a trend. And it is also, when it arrives in the human mind, it's also a call to action. It's a, there's something implicit there that I think is just mm-hmm. fine to engage with in a way that I hope in its best form would be an invitation for people to bring their own solutions, whether they be liberal or conservative or some other stripe, to solving this particular problem. Because there's no political philosophy that argues itself annihilation and the destruction, the wholesale destruction of beauty around the world can be a good thing. We differ in how we perceive trends that are happening now and how we think what the best solutions might be, you know, the role of government, the role of the market, and so on. And that's where the conversation is not there right now, and particularly in the US, but that's where we need to get to invite people from the conservative, liberal, and more, all the various realms of the political arena to bring their best solutions to bear on these trends, these crises that we're facing.
All right, everyone, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, Pimsleur. And remember, you have a free 7-day trial waiting just for you. Let's talk about exactly what you'll get out of it. Pimsleur is a conversational method for learning a new language. It's the way you'll actually use a new language in conversation. It was actually developed by Dr. Pimsleur, P-I-M-S-L-E-U-R, an applied linguist and professor at UCLA and Ohio State. And this is all about conversation. You're going to actually learn by conversing and training your ears to understand native speakers, which is so important because I can tell you what, I have a lot of book education in Spanish, not so good at actually speaking it or hearing it. You can reach an intermediate level in just 30 days, which is pretty cool. It's pretty exciting. And you can even extend beyond that if you'd like to. And with Pimsleur, you don't have to find time after a long day at work to get back in front of the computer to sit down and learn the new language. 75% of Pimsleur customers learn it on the go, you know, on their mobile devices. It works too. I have to tell you, it works. It's based on scientific evidence. The FBI uses it, Homeland Security, the State Department, the Marine Corps, the Navy, Fortune 500 companies, diplomats, journalists, aid workers, business executives. So many different people have used it to learn new languages quickly. So if you have a big trip coming up, if you have a relationship with someone who you'd like to be able to have conversations with more fluidly, I highly recommend it. Don't just take my word for it. You can try the full course absolutely free for 7 days. It's risk-free. You don't have anything to lose by trying, but you do have everything to gain: a new language, a new perspective, a better understanding of other cultures. So right now you should go to pimspeaks.com/nerdy. That's pimspeaks.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. And I think that, you know, what sometimes is a source of frustration for myself as, you know, a science communicator, and many of my peers is the lack of an ability to kind of reach across the aisle to discuss these things sometimes that, you're right, that have a shared vision, but sometimes the political will simply isn't there. You know, when we have solutions in front of us, when we, mm-hmm. you know, scientifically at least, know what we could be doing to affect change, yet politically there are stops to enforce these things.
Yes, and of course there has been a concerted effort over at least the last two decades from corporate interests and individuals who've made money from those corporations to try and move the conversation into this realm, say, of climate denial and so forth. And of course, the data on how people within the U.S. have shifted their opinions as a result of those deliberate campaigns of misinformation are well known, and we're living in, and the whole planet is living into the consequences of that. Solutions to that problem, I think, occur at many different levels, but one of them is an invitation into community with the rest of life. So, and you know, a tree is not a being that sits on the conservative or liberal end of the political spectrum. And if more people actually are connected into the seasonal rhythms of what's happening in their neighborhoods, into the migrations of the birds, the flows of the rivers, not only is that going to root us in our actual family and community, which is the larger ecological community, but it also gives us a place to stand as we encounter these debates and these manipulations that come from all different sides. And so in the delight of taking a walk through a park in the spring, you know, the human senses delight in the opening of the tree buds and so forth. There are also the roots of the stories that we really need, that our kids and grandkids and our students and friends are going to need to hear from us. Our lived experience in the world, if we don't have that engagement with other species, if we're just living and making decisions through graphs in scientific papers and through the policy positions of different political parties, we have unrooted ourselves. And even with the best intentions, we will be living in the vapor of self-delusion. And so a walk in the park or swim in the river, a gaze upwards into the clouds and the birds is an act of reconnecting with the real world. And I think that's very healing. And it also provides us a place where we can kind of break out of the shackles of I don't like those people because they voted for the wrong party and so forth. And I feel that anger very deeply. I need a place to be, to find that community, to find that commonality. And then, as I said, bring our best ideas from wherever we are on the political spectrum to bear and into conversation with one another.
You know, you mentioned a walk in the park, a swim in the river, a gaze up to the clouds. And I think many people, especially those who live in urban centers, those who live in cities, often think, as we mentioned before, of those things as separate, as destinations. But there's so much that we can be doing within our own kind of home environment to accommodate, I guess maybe that's a good way to put it, accommodate the urban wildlife, the urban nature that exists here and existed here long before we poured our concrete pads, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, the and particularly in urban areas that have had some intentional design to involve a few trees and to provide spaces where people can walk and can gather outside. And the primary method, I think, or at least the first method, has to be opening the senses to the city. So, for example, in Harlem, which of course is a very built-up area, I lived there for a few months, and what was astounded by the changing smells of the city streets based on the trees, when the trees were blooming. So the linden trees were opening their flowers in the early summer, and the whole neighborhood was perfumed by these trees. And this is a neighborhood right on a, you know, very busy street and so forth. There are lots of other smells, lots of other sounds in that neighborhood. But from opening our senses, we can come to connect to those other creatures and then connect to the stories of those places. And which stories are most important depends on the nature of the community that we're in. It's not one particularly toxic strand of American environmentalism, I think, is to believe that the values of rural America have to be imported to the city. You know, the rural people need to, Thomas Jefferson was very clear about this, so was John Muir and so on, that they regarded the cities as these diseased places that one needed to escape. And in fact, now we're seeing that, in fact, if we are going to live well on this planet, cities are the solution. They're the places where people have less environmental impact than folks living out in the country. And in the city, relationship with other species takes very different forms than it does in the country. And those forms are just as beautiful and just as real and life-giving as a so-called wilderness experience in the backcountry. Now, it doesn't also then mean that we don't need the rural areas or we don't need areas where the human influence is rather slight. No, the city and the countryside, the city and the wilderness need one another. They live in dynamic conversation, in interrelationship, just as the forest soils are formed only through relationship, through interconnection between fungi and bacteria and trees and invertebrate animals. That is the 3.5 billion year old story of life on this planet, is that we face challenges through interconnection, through carefully negotiated mutualisms, not through going it alone, through separation, through wall building.
Oh, gosh, I'm so glad you said that. You know, one thing that I sort of took home from the experience that I had when I spent some time in the Amazon rainforest was it sort of built on something that I had already become quite aware of as an individual with several friends who are entomologists, several friends who are ecologists. I had begun to become a little bit more aware of the tiny organisms mm-hmm. that I was sort of cohabitating with. And when I spent time in the rainforest, I realized that the individuals who live there, whether they be, you know, city folks from Lima who were doing work in the rainforest or, you know, indigenous peoples who were employed by these different lodges and worked as nature guides, there was a relationship with the organisms. You know, one thing as an aside that I definitely noticed is when you first arrive, you almost don't notice anything alive around you. You have this idea in your head, oh, the rainforest is teeming with life. And then you get there and you're like, where's all this life? Mm-hmm. Because you haven't yet learned to see it. And the longer you spend there, the more you start to see it. And of course, I noticed that they had an understanding of, let's just talk about insects first, an understanding of which insects were dangerous to approach, which insects required some coaxing, you know, pulling a tarantula out of a hole through acting like a prey animal with a stick, or no, avoid the wandering spider because if they bite you, you're not going to be happy, or the bullet ant, or don't touch that brightly colored caterpillar. But of course, these butterflies you can get as close to as you'd like, or this, you know, insect light trap, let's look at all these moths and learn from them. I took that home and I realized it's okay when the brown widows are living in the corners of my front door. They are eating all of the mosquitoes that I don't want in my house. You know, when I come across insects now, I treat them on an individual basis instead of this, I think, very Western modern view of like, there's a bug in my house, I should kill it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And of course, that we have the political manifestation of that view happening right now. There are the other is in our country. We need to get rid of them. You know,
and, absolutely. And, that dehumanization, yeah. For sure.
And you know, what you described, I think, is a beautiful description of what it means to be a fully alive human. That's what our ancestors did for hundreds of thousands of years. They lived within their community and over time came to understand what the roles of various insects and mammals and birds and trees and fungi were within the ecosystem, and what a healthy relationship between people and that creature might be. For a lot of the time, it just means leave them alone. And you know, they have some indirect benefits for us maybe, but most creatures live lives that are at least somewhat dissociated from our own human self-interest. And then others, of course, are actively quite dangerous to us. And others are extremely beneficial. We have life only through attention to their lives. And so our senses attuned to that. I mean, that's what natural selection did to the human nervous system. It tuned us to sound frequencies, to textures on bark, to smells in the air or smells coming from the soil that are relevant to human thriving. And one reason why getting into relationships, say, with a tree, wherever that tree may be, or with another creature, attending, say, to the sounds of birds, learn to identify 10 of the most common species of birds in your neighborhood is incredibly enriching, because it allows us to re-inhabit the body that we were born into. Whereas all these other, you know, the devices like the phone device on my desk here and the TV and so on, those are very poor replicas of that very rich experience that's open to us. You mentioned the tiny organisms, and that's the thing that blew me away in a lot of my studies, is how over days and weeks and then years, I came to see that the ecosystem was ruled by what I think of as the inconspicuous proletariat, all the tiny little gnats and ants and nematodes and the root hairs and the minuscule little mushrooms. You know, think of mushrooms as these great big portobello things you see in the supermarket and so on. And yet, get down on lie down on your belly on the forest floor with a hand lens pressed to your eye. And there's this whole universe of hundreds of tiny, tiny little mushrooms with little snails moving among them. I mean, just beyond what the human, unaided human eye can perceive is this entire world. So I tell my students, you know, bypass the psychedelic drugs for a little while. Just get yourself a hand lens. You will be blown away, and you will open your nervous system to this, what seems at first like a dream world, this incredible, fantastic world that is in fact our world. And perhaps the psychedelics can sort of open us to other dimensions of that too. But if we're not rooted in and grounded in the sensory appreciation of this world, man, we're missing out. We're sort of, we're turning our back on the great gift that's being offered to us. And that is, in a way, it's almost like the old theistic tradition's view of sin is to turn your back on God. And that, you know, I don't particularly identify myself in those traditions, but in an ecological context, if we die in this world knowing more brand names than trees, if we know more jingles, corporate advertising jingles, than we know the names and songs of birds, it's a sad thing, because we have lost out on this great music that took literally 3 billion years, more than 3 billion years to compose. We've lost out on that opportunity. What a great loss. And it's there for free. You don't need to buy the app. It's free download from the universe. That's why I use the word joy. And, of course, other writers, Michael McCarthy and others, have done a great job of elevating that word of joy. There's a joy in this engagement. And then, of course, there's the bittersweetness of realizing that, that great music is dimming. It's being broken. But you know, there's hope there. Mm-hmm. We can engage and become productive parts of the symphony, if you like. But the choice is ours. And we, as I said, we'll only make wise decisions if we are, in fact, listening within life's community rather than looking in from an imagined outside.
It really does worry me that, you know, so many people that I encounter view a naturalistic understanding of the world to be something that is only for the experts. It's quite a different view than basically through all of human history, when naturalism really kind of required no expertise. It required simply time and focus. You know, even Darwin wasn't a trained scientist. Yeah. He was a naturalist. He just was interested and curious. And it does seem like the naturalist tradition is fading in the minds of at least young people in modern society. And that worries me greatly. I mean, I think that I'm sort of, I don't know, a victim, maybe I should say a perpetrator of that, that I probably just simply don't spend enough time outside, sitting in the dirt, just being, exploring, digging, doing the things that we all did as children, but for some reason lose as we get older and think of them as kind of maybe less quote-unquote civilized.
Yeah, so of course we all live in structures that draw us out of that. They keep us in electronic cages, you know, our jobs, that even just going to procure food for ourselves and so on, which of course used to be a very relational, ecological thing, and now it involves mostly plastic things, wrapped up in plastics, even in the more kind of eco stores, we're walking through a human mediated world. And I absolutely agree with you that most people, and I would include myself in this, don't get enough playtime in relation to the trees or to soil or to other creatures. We get some of that through our pets. That's why, of course, we take great delight in our cats and dogs, because we interact with these mammalian creatures that are reminders, deep reminders of our kinship to other beings and what it is to be playfully and lovingly engaged with another. We can take that to another level, a more diffuse level, perhaps, within a forest. In my travels and so on, I actually feel that we're in an age of a great resurgence of naturalism. And it's actually a more healthy naturalism because it includes the urban areas, and in fact, often is most vital within urban areas, most vital in a life. Lots and lots of young people are really interested in engaging and learning about the nature in their local communities. There are lots more organizations now than when I was a kid decades ago, encouraging and helping people with that. And in some of the electronic mm-hmm. world, for example, documentary films or the iNaturalist app, eBird and so on. These are electronic ways in which stories can reach us and inspire us to say, okay, thank you very much, digital device, for inspiring me and showing me the way. Now I'm going to go and interact with some other devices, the trees. I mean, a tree is not a device. It's a living being. That's a mechanical analogy that's a little inappropriate, but it is another being full of intelligence and memory and so forth in a way that some of our electronic devices are. So I do think there is a gap there. There are many challenges. Of course, kids are being, Silicon Valley is designing things to draw kids' attentions away from the community of life into the community of profit making, of digital capture. And with the number of hours that most kids spend per day, per week, locked into electronic devices is terrifying, and then we know how terrifying it is because many of the originators of these technologies will not allow their kids to have them. So it's like, I'll grow the crack, I'll give you the opioids, I'll give you the cocaine, the electronic cocaine, but I will not take it myself. I will not let my kids have this. And challenge me, it seems extraordinarily fractured view of the world. There is not a naturalist in the world who says, "Oh, I'll do this. I'll go bird watching myself, but I won't bring my children with me on this because I know this will destroy a part of them." No, the people who are super keen bird watchers try to involve their kids in that. The people who love to be in relation with trees or with rivers want to invite young people into that deep, life-giving relationship. And so we're in a time, I think, of great opportunity, but also of design, deliberate challenge to that basic human right, maybe. I mean, rights is a very difficult philosophical area, but the right to be in relation with other creatures, to not have our minds drawn away from the living earth community that is our only home, that is where we belong, and that is facing great challenges and crises now that need our attention.
So many important points that you're making, so many things that are resonating with me really deeply. In some of the work, that I've done here in Los Angeles, the city that I absolutely love, it's not my native city. I grew up in Texas, but it is now my home and I think will be for quite a long time. A colleague of mine, when I was working on a local PBS kind of current of events show, did a beautiful story about tree cover in the city and really, talked about this bimodal distribution, wherein you see that in rural areas or, areas where there is kind of less population explosion and maybe the poverty level or the individuals living at the poverty level is high, you see a large number of trees. And then in the richest parts of the city, you see a large number of trees, but sort of in the low to middle class parts of the city is it like, or even the more impoverished parts of the city per se, not the rural area, is where people struggle to actually connect with nature the most. And it really is a social justice issue that trees give life and trees give health and psychological well-being. And without having them in these more impoverished areas, people are basically being doubly hurt.
Yes, and particularly because trees are also cleaning the air. So the health of lungs is negatively affected by the loss of urban trees. And this, the good thing, I agree that, you know, the experience in LA also is those trends are also true in other cities. The really good thing, though, is that we now know this. People are awake to this reality and to how serious it is. And so a number of cities, and I don't know the details of urban forestry and city planning in LA, but a number of other cities actually use maps of where, GIS maps, of where the city has few trees and where rates of lung health are particularly bad, so rates of hospitalization for asthma and so forth. And where those maps coincide, there's a strategy of going into those neighborhoods and planting trees. And so looking to the future to erase some of these environmental injustices. And what happens within those is very interesting. Part of tree biology emerges in this, is that if municipal workers go into a neighborhood and plant trees, those trees have a, you know, maybe 50-50 chance of still being around in 10 years because it's a very challenging environment to be on, right on the sidewalk and so on, and the ground gets very dry, and people lock their bikes to the tree and someone hits it with a car and so forth. So now, that's if you have municipal workers do this. If you involve people from the community in the tree planting, if you put a little tag on the tree that says, hello, I'm your new tree, here's what species I am. If it's a dry summer, give me a little water, don't let your dog poop here, and so forth. That tree's probability of survival goes to nearly 100% because it's been given, at least over those first few years, because you've given that tree membership within the human social network. So trees and cities derive their life from connection with people, from connection, from awareness of people, from the relationships, the friendships, if you like, between people and trees in a particular neighborhood. And then there's a reciprocity too, because then there's very good data now from cities around the world showing that when we're in neighborhoods where we have some trees and some other species contributing to our everyday lives, that's not only good for the health of the cells in our lungs, but also is very good for our psychological well-being. Many other factors, of course, but trees are one of those positive factors.
Absolutely. You know, you see the same effect with CSAs, with community supported agriculture. When you have farms, you know, even sometimes under freeway overpasses in very poor communities where the community members themselves can come and tend to the land, and then they get the fruits and the vegetables, the produce out of it. There's more care that's taken. There's more commitment to it when you are the one who is growing the food yourself with your own hands. And you see it with children too. Children are more likely to eat vegetables when they're involved in growing the vegetables because there's less fear of the unknown. There's more control and command of that. I have to say that I'm very proud to live in a community. I live in right by Griffith Park here in Los Angeles that takes urban wildlife very seriously. My friends at the Natural History Museum, Beth Pratt, who is the California head of the National Wildlife Federation, and basically did everything she could to successfully make P22, who is our resident mountain lion that lives in Griffith Park, basically famous. We have a P22 day every year where we celebrate the connectivity. And also she's raised money to build a wildlife crossing here to help improve connectivity, which is a massive problem when cities are broken up by freeways, you know, that these animals die when they're trying to expand their home range. And of course, trees are hugely important in these kinds of big city projects. So I have to say that I'm really proud to live in a city where there is so much focus on that. And it's wonderful for me to hear your feedback that in all of your travels and your writings, that you're seeing that this is an effort in cities across the globe.
It is, and it's an effort that can benefit enormously from all of our help. So many of these programs, as you know, can struggle financially and can struggle because there's not enough support in, you know, city council meetings and so on. But they're extraordinarily enriching for communities and for the human imagination, because when we know that, say, there's a mountain lion living in the hills there, or that we have helped grow the kale that is on our plate, or that we know the name of the tree that is living on our street, our imagination is drawn into the lives of those other creatures and down into the soil and up into the air. And so the human mind expands the possibility for creative expression, for thoughts about the future, then expands because it has expanded into that great network of life that we're embedded in, rather than being folded ever inwards with self-regard and stories that are just about ourselves.
On that note, David, I have to ask, because I've kept you for about an hour now, and I don't want to keep you away from your work any longer, but I generally close my episode of Talk Nerdy each week by asking my guests the same two questions. They're quite big picture questions, but I'm always amazed at the depth and the breadth of the answers that my guests share with me. So are you ready for my two big picture questions?
Yes, I am.
All right.
Come on.
So I want you to, as you often do in your work, put yourself in a position where you're thinking about the future, and that can be in whatever context is relevant to you and your mind right now. But I want you to tell me the first question. When you think about the future, what is the thing that really does keep you up the most at night, that's quite disconcerting for you, and that maybe you even sometimes venture into pessimism with regards to it? But then on the flip side of that, so of course we end on a bit of a more positive note, what is the thing when you look to the future that you are quite, you know, fundamentally and genuinely optimistic about?
Thank you. Yes, you know, and I think that these questions navigate that space, optimism and pessimism, and the space in between there is hope. And hope can exist without either disposition. And I think it was Wendell Berry who said, it's not so much our job to decide whether we should have hope or be optimistic and pessimistic, but to get on with the work that needs to be done. And the next generation will judge whether we had grounds for hope. The thing that I worry, one of the things that I worry most about, it sounds rather abstract, but it's non-linearity. And that is changes, we understand now in ecological systems, the changes are seldom proceed in a linear fashion for long. For example, you increase calcium concentration in a cell, or you increase temperature within a lake and so forth. And then we reach a point where the system flips into a different mode, a different set of rhythms and so forth. And we've got so much rapid change in so many ecological and human communities, and the human community is part of that great ecological system, that our current projections, whether they be about politics, economics, climate change, biodiversity, and so on, can't bring into them, it's almost impossible mathematically to bring in those unexpected nonlinearities, that we flip into a state where the challenge suddenly gets much, much deeper. So a specific example of that, for example, might be the forests in the Western United States, where the acreage of forest fires have been increasing year by year, decade by decade. Mm-hmm. And now perhaps we're moving into a new era, into an era where the previous fires look just almost insignificant, despite their great destructive and sorrowful power that they've had to this present moment. So that's one place. Carbon from boreal soils is another, the great flow of carbon to the atmosphere. So a place for great optimism is when I'm around young students who have this great eagerness and curiosity, which is part of what it means to be a human being, when that curiosity can reach other eager minds, and those minds can be in relation with the mind of the soil, the memories and the understandings that are encoded in the lives of trees, when those minds reach up into the flight of birds, the capacity to not just find solutions to problems in the present day moment, but to find beautiful things that we cannot even imagine in our generation now, is just extraordinary. So the human species, the capacity to find beauty and to innovate into ways that are not just technically clever, but in fact are life-giving and life-enhancing, is just extraordinary. And when I'm with that kind of energy, I leave feeling exalted and delighted and very optimistic. And of course, that energy I feel most keenly when the human mind is in relation to the mind of other creatures, when people are gathered in forest around trees on a street in an urban area, or watching migratory birds fly over a city. That is the place of great inspiration and beauty, and therefore of hope.
Well, David, I have to thank you so, so much. You know, the great poetry and profundity with which you speak, with which you write, they're truly inspirational. I feel like this was a great gift to have a chance to speak with you for a full hour today. Guys, the books, plural, I should say, are The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature, and more recently, The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. David, where can people find more of your work? Is there an outlet that you've been writing for more recently? Are you active at all on social media? How can they kind of follow you?
Yes. So the books are the primary places where my work is manifest. I'm on most of the social media platforms, have a website that guides people to that, dghaskell.com. My invitation, though, is not so much onto my social media accounts, but would be an invitation to all the listeners, is this week, go out and find a tree and commit to return to that tree again and again over the next few weeks with nothing but enthusiastic openness of your senses, and see where that particular social media connection takes you as you deepen your relationship with that tree and the stories of that particular place. Then tell those stories back out into your own networks, whether it's Instagram or talking to people around a table in the evenings, or sharing things with your families in the mornings.
Absolutely wonderful advice. And I think I'm going to take you up on that challenge myself. David, thank you so much for joining me. It really was a joy.
Thank you. It was a great honor to join you. And thank you for your amazing work singing that music of science into the world. Thank you.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.